everybody, how you doing? Well, that's good. Welcome to a very special edition of BSH Radio. While my partners are off for Labor Day, I, Bill Matcher, Director of Fun and Games, I have a very special interview with you. I am bringing you one of my longest tenured friends, I would say. He is a mental training and peak performance specialist at KPEX Consulting in Pittsburgh. Is it KPEX or KPEX?
KPEX.
All right. Awesome. He has a master's degree in sports and performance psychology from the University of Denver. Let me introduce to you, honestly, most importantly, the guy who told me I was one of the best teammates he ever played hockey with, Donato Finelli. How are you tonight, Donato?
Yeah, well, let's get it clear right away, Bill. You were one of my favorite teammates of all time from a strictly mental standpoint.
Yeah.
If we're talking skating, stick handling, shot, you were brutal. You were a terrible hockey player. But as far as the mentality for a teammate, man, I knew you were always going to give it your best. I knew you always had my back in whatever fights we got into. And I know we were going to joke around and drink beers after the game, win or lose. So,
hey.
From a mental standpoint, yes, absolutely. You were one of my favorite, if not my number one favorite teammate of all time.
Donato, I take exception to the skating part. The shooting and passing and puck handling and knowing what to do, yeah, that was tough. But I could skate. But anyway, we're here to talk about what you do, Donato. You and I have just gotten in basically a bunch of drunk conversations about what it is to be a mental training and peak performance specialist. And with a lot of things happening in sports right now, I thought this was a great time to dive into this, whether it be Carter Hart with his sports psychologist, things going on with the Phillies, things going on with Andrew Luck. It just seems like there's more of an emphasis than ever on the mental side of the game. So I wanted to start and talk to you. So first and foremost, I mean, what is a mental training and peak performance specialist?
Well, let me play a little some mind games with you and your
Christ.
Listeners and answer your question with a question. And so, Bill, if you were to put a percentage on it, how much of hockey would you say is mental?
What's the quote? 90% is half mental. Everything is mental preparation, right? It's at least 50%, I would say. You need to have the skills and all that, but if you're not mentally prepared, it doesn't matter how good you are, I would say.
You're right. First and foremost, you need to have the physical and the technical skills down first, but, you know, you said it's at least 50%. So if hockey's at least 50% mental, how much time do you think the average hockey player spends training the mental side? Do they spend 50% of their time doing it?
I doubt most hockey players dedicate as much time to that aspect as they do learning how to do the Michigan, I would say.
Right. You know, anyone that's ever played hockey, anyone that's ever played any sport, anyone that's ever done any kind of performing would tell you that a big part of it is mental. And so that's essentially what my job is. Simply put, my job is help athletes develop mental toughness through mental skills training. And so my mission is to help these athletes use mental skills to optimize their potential, overcome challenges, and really just improve overall well-being. And the reason I'm qualified to do this work is because I have my master's degree in sport and performance psychology from the University of Denver. So I have advanced training in the science and application of sports psychology, as well as some generalized knowledge and training in counseling and psychology.
All right. For when you say prepare for the mental aspects of the game, sports performance is part of your specialty. So how does it differ from, say, traditional counseling or therapy or things like that?
Right. That's a really good question. And I think that it's important for people in the sport culture to understand what the difference between what I do and what traditional counseling or therapy is. So my expertise is in performance enhancement. My expertise is not in mental health. Right. So when we say mental toughness, that's completely different than mental health. Mental health entails clinical issues, so things like depression, anxiety, addiction, PTSD, and these are things that are diagnosed and treated by a licensed psychologist or a licensed counselor. When we say mental toughness, those are skills and strategies that help an athlete to overcome challenges they face and ultimately reach their peak performance levels. Right, and mental toughness is something that's developed through mental skills training, and it can also just enhance their overall well-being and also prevent in some of the other more clinical disorders or help them cope with some of those things. And so what I do, I think a lot of people have it in their head that they come in to some office with mahogany furniture and books, you know, miles long, and, you know, they lay down on the couch and they talk about their feelings. And you're not going to come down, lay down on the couch and talk about your feelings with me. Don't get me wrong, maybe there is a time and a place for that, but what I do, it's the type of work that I do, it's a lot more dynamic and it's holistic. And I think one of the really cool and exciting parts about the work that I do is that I can meet the athletes on their own turf, and pun 110% intended there. But, you know, I can meet athletes at the rink. I can meet them on the golf course. So much of the good work that I'm able to do is just simply having, like, little side conversations on the team bus or on the sidelines with the player. Because, you know, to be completely honest with you, none of this stuff is rocket science. I wouldn't go as far to say that it's common sense, but I think I could show you all the theories and all the research and all the science, and you would say, you know what, like, that's, like, pretty logical. It just makes sense. And I think for a lot of these athletes, just hearing it from a different point of view or hearing it from a different perspective, I think that's what's able to help them, it click for them and start to apply these skills.
So this is one of the aspects I've been most interested in since we've been talking about this stuff, is this idea of mental toughness. And you just went on an explanation of the differences, you know, mental health, mental toughness. It's a different thing. But we talk about athletes, especially in my business, as it's a binary state. You're either mentally tough or you're mentally weak. But you've talked to me about how this is a developable skill. Like, it's the same, not the same as, but you can do things to improve it, like you can puck handling or whatever. Just how do you go about doing that?
Well, you know, these are skills. So they are absolutely something that can be developed and improved with training and practice. And it really just depends on what the skill is. To start off with my work is just a lot of getting to know the athlete and understand them, because with all of these mental skills, they're not one size fits all. They work a little bit differently for everyone else. You know, everyone comes in with different experiences, different strengths, different weaknesses, different things that they want to work on, different things that I think would be beneficial for them. And so a lot of it is just having conversation and getting deeper to understand deeper meaning in things. I think sometimes it can be rather abstract. It is something that is, to be honest with you, it's hard to measure. It is hard to quantify. You know, mental toughness isn't necessarily something that you can put your hands on and hold it. It's one of those things that when you see it, you just kind of know it. And to be honest with you, I think that's one of the biggest challenges for the professionals in my field that we're in, because we live in a numbers-driven society, and sports in particular are so numbers driven. So it being really hard to show some quantifiability behind mental skills, it's a challenge to overcome, because, you know, so many of these old school people want to see, you know, hard results. They want to see numbers. And for me, that's tough to do. I think the best way to do it is taking a step back and just looking at the bigger picture. You know, is the athlete performing at their highest level more consistently? Does the athlete say that they feel more confident, they feel more motivated, they're better able to focus? Are the coaches seeing the team buy in and, you know, be a part of the team and be motivated and all? And, you know, like I said, it is hard to quantify, but there is some work to be able to do that. We're going on right now. Dr. Scott Goldman, he's the sports psychologist for the Detroit Lions and Miami Dolphins, and he created what's called the AIQ, the Athlete Intelligence Quotient. And the AIQ is an intelligence test that assesses the innate cognitive abilities that are utilized in sport, like attaining, developing, and applying athletic skills, strategies, and talents. And so, you know, I think you hear a lot of stories from, like, combines and all about, like, the players getting asked, like, these really bizarre
questions.
And that, what this is not that. A lot of that is just throwing shit at a wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah, I feel like that, a lot of that, not to cut you off, but I feel like a lot of, so much of that comes from the idea that you said this isn't quantifiable. So you have these basically untrained guys, but they know sports, so they go, let's just throw something ridiculous at him and see how he reacts. Yes, maybe his composure when you say, hey, have you ever had sex with a man? Maybe his composure can tell you something in that situation, or maybe you're just screwing with him. There's really no way to know, but since they're not trained in this stuff, it's their best shot at kind of what you do, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's some of those questions they ask, there is no right or wrong answer. They're seeing
how you react.
They respond, and I'm sure each team has completely different reasons of why they would ask certain questions. The AIQ is driven to be more quantifiable. It's backed by empirically invalidated evidence. So there's a lot more hardcore science and data behind this. And now the AIQ is becoming fairly commonplace in the NHL, NFL, NBA, MLB, and NCAA. And so I think that's the step in the direction that the field's going to go is figuring out how all this stuff can become more quantifiable so we can have some numbers to back up.
All right, excellent. We'll get into the idea of it being quantifiable a little bit more as we move along. But first, I just want to get a little bit more background information on you. You attended, obviously, the University of Denver, got your master's degree there. When did you attend?
So I graduated June 2018. This is a two-year program.
All right, so yeah, we drove you out there in 2016, right? That's when that was?
It was a great road trip. Yeah. You crushed it on the trail mix game.
Trail mix is what it's all about, man. You worked with the hockey program in some capacity, right?
Yeah, so I was just simply a hockey operations volunteer. So I got to hang out in the press box for home games and track stats and help break down film after the games. I got to hang around at practices. I learned a lot about some of the logistics of college hockey as far as like scheduling and planning out things and all. And it was a really cool experience to have, a front row seat to a national championship season and then a Frozen Four season in 2018. So yeah, that was a, I helped in a very limited capacity and it was just a volunteer work, but it was really cool to be around that team at that time.
You told me that it was more so your professors than your work with the athletic department or the hockey team that really some of your most interesting subjects.
Oh yeah, the professors I had at DU were awesome. Like they just some of the really top notch and most respected people in this field, like Dr. Mark Aowagi. He's the director of the program. He's a sports psychologist for the Denver Broncos. And at least once a class, he would just say drop this little one liner that we would just be like. Like, whoa, where did that come from? And, all the other professors, they have experience in working with the highest level athletes. Being so close to Colorado Springs, they all have experience working with the USOC, so working with the Olympians and the Paralympians and all. And, yeah, I mean, like, my program at DU was awesome, and I was so lucky to learn from some of the top people in the field.
How did you freaking get into this, dude? What? This is so ridiculous. I can't imagine having such a serious job. Like, how did you get from, because, me and you played some hockey together. I know, you wanted to be a coach at one point. How did this all come about for you?
You know what, dude? I gotta be honest with you. That is my favorite question to ask my colleagues, because everyone that works in this field has a cool story of why they work in this field. And I don't think anyone grows up dreaming about growing up to be the mental skills and peak performance consultant. You want to be the athlete out there playing.
Of course.
So most of the people in this field are people that come from an athletic background, and for whatever experiences they had along the way, whether good or bad, it ultimately led them to realize how important the mental side of it was. And so for me, I played D1 ACHA hockey at Rutgers University for 4 straight national championship appearances, for sure. And so after I stopped playing hockey, I got into coaching. And when you coach the game, you see it from a much different perspective than you do as a player. And very quickly through coaching, I realized that what held me most back as a player had absolutely nothing to do with my skill set. It was all between my ears, you know, and I was never the most talented player. I never had the most skill by any means. Like I always say, like I have Charlie Conway syndrome. Like I, you know, I was going to be a much better player than, or much better coach than a player. But you know, like I played with no confidence, and I wasn't able to keep my emotions in check on the ice. And so this realization kind of sparked an interest in the mental side of sport. And so I started reading some different coaching books and all. And you know, it was one thing led to another. It was never like some big aha moment. It was never like something I had, you know, wanted to do for years and years and years. It was a lot of experiences adding up over time. And I think it really just goes back to my love for sports, man. Like I fucking love sports, and I feel just like talking about the sports. And you know, like that's kind of how this idea for this whole interview came up. Like us just hanging out like we normally do, and talking about sports, and like getting deep and like to the what ifs and all. And just it's such a cool job. Like the work is so fun. It's so exciting. It's challenging. And, you know, basically I just get to hang out with athletes and ask them a bunch of ridiculous questions. Sports and questions, my two favorite things.
Yeah, man. Oh, you do enjoy very much asking the questions. I got it. You talked a little bit about how this isn't rocket science, but like everybody's motivators, everybody is motivated by different things. And I want to get into the idea of motivation, but first, you talked about what held you back as an athlete. What would you say, if there's a way to generalize, what are the top impediments for athletes in terms of why they don't reach their peak performance?
Why they don't reach their peak performance? You know, there isn't one overarching answer. It's going to be, and it depends.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on the athlete. It depends on the circumstances. Now, are you getting at, like, if some athletes are clutch and some are...
We could definitely get into that. I just kind of wanted to get into, like, if everybody's motivations are different, how do you figure out, how do you get to, okay, this works for this guy? Like, how do you get to that? This is how I'm coaching this guy.
Me, how I'm coaching this guy, or just how I'm doing the work I'm doing with them?
Like, how you're telling him, yeah, how you're doing your work with an athlete.
So, again, it goes back to, you know, it depends on the situation, but really a lot of the work is just getting to know someone, and the way you get to know someone is just asking questions. So when I have a session with an athlete, it just very much feels like we're having a conversation, and we're just, you know, I'm asking a lot of open-ended questions, a lot of really non-directive stuff, and you start to, like, put the pieces of the puzzle together. You know, like, some athletes do some things really well. For others, that's really challenging for them. Something that comes naturally for one person is something that's completely new and different for another person. And like I said, it's not one size fits all, so it's you're asking these open-ended questions, you're getting to know them, you're building a relationship, you know, far more than any theoretical orientation or any science or any research I can show these athletes. What's most important is that I show them that I care. But I just generally show them that I actually care about them as a person, not just an athlete. You know, when I have my very first session with an athlete, I spend the first half of the session at least just asking the questions about them and their lives. And, like, I tell them, you know, like, well, we'll get to your sport in a little bit, but, like, let me get to know you a little bit better. And, you know, some athletes open up really quickly, and, you know, they're very type A personalities, and you can just go boom, boom, boom. Others are more abstract in their thinking and all. So, you know, you're really getting to know the person and understanding where they're at, where they want to get to. And it's very collaborative work. You know, I have the expertise on mental skills training, but you have the expertise on you.
Okay.
So in order for us to figure out what's best for you, let's both of us use our expertise. I'll use my expertise in the mental skills. You use expertise in you, and we'll figure it out. And you know, it takes time. There are, like, some quick fixes I could give you just like that, just like some quick pointers and all. And you know, for some people, that's all they need. For other people, it takes a little bit more time. You got to get deeper into it.
Right, like I said earlier, the reason I thought this interview would really resonate with my listeners is because ever since Carter Hart came into Flyers fans' collective consciousness, we've been reading and hearing about his sports psychologist. And, I mean, it goes beyond just techniques. Like, we've seen when he gives up a goal, he squirts a water bottle into the air and just follows one drop all the way down to the ice, and it resets him completely mentally. Is that kind of... We've talked about the difference between psychology and what you're doing, but is that kind of, when you say quick fixes, is that just one little thing? Like, it's different for everybody, but is that, like, kind of what you do?
Yeah, so from what I've read, with his sports psychologist.
John Stevenson is his name.
Yes, exactly. John Stevenson. And the work that John Stevenson does with Carter Hart, as well as Braden Holtby.
Yes.
John Stevenson worked with Braden Holtby and I believe some other NHL players as well. From what I've read online, it sounds like it's performance work. Now, I don't know like how deep they get into things. You know, like John Stevenson isn't going to be allowed to tell us if there's some more clinical or mental health stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, really, I don't know what's going on in their sessions. However, from what I've read and what's been made available to the public, that's performance enhancement work. That's mental skills training. And so, yes, Carter Hart.
It's so good. It just sticks, man. It just sticks.
Yeah, I can't hear his name and not think of that.
I need mental skills training to get it out of my head.
So Carter Hart's been working with John Stevenson since he was in grammar school. So, you know, since he was kid. And, you know, Carter Hart has said that when they first started having sessions, it was very basic, very foundational. And as he's gotten older and more mature and more experienced with it, they've gotten deeper and deeper and deeper into the stuff. I think the big thing with Carter Hart was that he started from a very young age. And so if parents are going to spend all this money for their kids to go to all these specialty camps and training seminars and all, why not invest in the mental skills training? Because they're going to learn life skills out of it. You know, they're going to, you know, any parent most parents put their kids into sport because they want them to learn about teamwork and leadership and commitment and all. Well, you learn about mental skills, you learn how you can apply those kinds of things to your life. And so I think that was one of the big things for Carter Hart, establishing that strong foundation in this stuff from a very early age. And yeah, so Carter Hart has said that every single day he goes to what he calls his mental gym. And every day, whether that's just 5 minutes or 45 minutes, it's something that he does every single day. And it's something that he does every single day, just like any of his other training, like his off-ice or on-ice training as well. And with when he goes to his mental gym, it could be something as simple as just 5 minutes of some breathing, 10 minutes of meditation, or maybe a half hour of some imagery. And regardless of what it is, it's something that's just part of his everyday training. You mentioned the water bottle thing. That's an awesome technique. Totally stole it and using it with some of my clients.
Nice.
Braden Holtby also uses it. And that's just like a simple little thing just to kind of to bring it back to the present moment. And so what he's doing, he's squirting the water bottle in the air, and he's picking one little droplet and just following that one droplet all the way down to the ice. And it's just a very simple and quick way to kind of reset and refocus and bring himself back in the present moment. One of the other things he does, he uses imagery a lot in general. And that's something he does before every game, you know, taking time to sit and visualize his opponent's strengths and like how he might respond to shooters. And some of the science behind imagery is really interesting. Like for instance, psychoneuromuscular theory says that basically whether the action is real or imagined, the same parts of your brain light up. So, you know, whether you're actually on the ice practicing making that save, or just sitting there laying in your bed thinking about moving that part of your body and making that save, ultimately the same parts of your brain are lighting up. And now I don't know the neuroscience at all, but like I know enough to speak layman's terms.
But I assume it's a lot like how I get just as fired up when I imagine an argument I might have in my head as like when I actually might do like have that. Like, you know, I get just as angry yelling at the guy I was pissed off about 30 minutes ago as I would if I was like yelling at him just me to you. So I can see that. But you're talking about like...
You yell most times.
Most of the time. Like, when we see when we see the pregame footage, like, oh, here's Braden Holtby just kind of sitting in the stands or sitting in on the bench and just kind of watching a mental game. Like, that's what we're looking at, him imagining it, and it's preparing him for the reality.
You know, I don't know if there's one most important mental skill, but I think most exceptional athletes are exceptional at imagery and visualization, whether they know it or not. And, you know, it's funny because really all imagery is just sitting there imagining yourself doing it. And it sounds pretty simple, but it's actually, like, really hard to do. And so the difference between visualization and imagery is that when you say visualization, it kind of insinuates that you're just seeing it, whereas imagery is about incorporating all of your senses.
Okay.
And so basically the more senses that you're using, the better, the more real it becomes, you know? So if you're not just seeing it, but you're also feeling it, you're also hearing it, smelling it, tasting it, that's going to make these images even more real, and it's going to make them even more effective. And so a guy like Braden Holtby, he's mastered imagery, you know, because he can sit in the stands and just imagine the entire game and every minute detail of the game. And the reason he's so good at it is because he practices it, you know. For most of us, just to sit there and use our imagination on something specific for 5 minutes would probably be really hard without, you know, trailing off. But, you know, the more you practice it, the better you're going to get at it. And guys like Carter Hart and Braden Holtby, they practice these mental skills every single day, and they get really good at them. And as a result, when it comes game time, you know, they put them to use.
Now, that's something I'm really interested in, because we spend a lot of time on BSH Radio, maybe not explaining away the idea of intangibles, but basically saying since there's no measure for it, then trying to quantify it when evaluating a player or roster construction isn't something really that, like, fans can do or media can do, and honestly, probably front offices mostly show, oh, we got this guy for his intangibles. Like, well, what does that mean? But you talked earlier about how you started the AIQ and how there's starting to be more of an idea of being able to measure mental skills. What are, like, we talked about routine. Like, what does routine do for an athlete? And kind of relate it to superstition, because we wanted to get into the routine versus superstition idea.
Right. I think a lot of exceptional athletes are quite superstitious. You know, like Sidney Crosby has talked a lot about his superstitions. He's very open about the fact that he's very superstitious. And athletes are also creatures of habits, whether they know it or not. Like, they have their set routines that they really adhere to, and those routines are very important to them. And so when you talk about a superstition is something that has absolutely nothing to do with your performance, even if you think it meant, right? A superstition is something that controls you, and they get more elaborate over time. So, for instance, like, the Phillies won a game because they got to put a bamboo plant in the clubhouse, so they won two games, and the whole freaking team had bamboo plants, and they won on a win streak because they were getting bamboo plants. No, the Phillies didn't win any games because they got bamboo plants. The Phillies won some games because they actually played some decent baseball for once this year. Similar routine, we also have rituals, and rituals are similar to superstitions in that they're an ordered series of events that you do, or an ordered series of superstitions that you do that have nothing to do with the actual performance. When you say a routine, that's something that gets you physically, emotionally, and mentally ready to play, right? And like I said, the top-level athletes are really good at doing that, because when you prepare for each game the same way, you come in with the same mindset every game. So when you're playing the really tough opponent, it's not, oh, crap, like, these guys are so good, like, we're going to have to play so good. No, you're just coming in with the same relaxed confidence, similar to when you're facing a lesser opponent. It's not, man, these guys are stink, we can just turn it down this week. No, you're keeping that same consistent mindset. And, you know, like, any athlete's going to go through their physical routine to warm up, and so why not go through a little mental routine to mentally warm up? And I think for your routine to be most effective, it should tie in both the physical and the mental, because, you know, that's what you're doing out on the ice. You're combining body and mind.
Yeah.
why not prepare that way? Why not prepare body and mind together?
And that's I just to say, to relate this to some of our listeners maybe who aren't high level athletes, like you've been just preaching how important routine is for just getting through your day. And, like, kind of relate it to non-athletes or people who maybe are, like, me. I have an odd schedule. So, like, some days I sleep till 10, some days I sleep till 1, and then I'm all thrown off and don't know what's up. These last couple days I've been setting a routine and sticking to it, and it just seems much easier to get everything done as it comes rather than just going with it as it happens.
You know, like, throughout college and all, it didn't matter if I got 4 hours of sleep, 8 hours of sleep, or 10 hours of sleep, I always woke up tired. And I had no idea why. When I learned a little bit about routines, you know, and I started sticking to the same morning routine and the same evening routine, just doing the same couple of things before bed and the same couple of things when I first get out of bed, it made such a huge difference in my ability to feel awake and engaged throughout the day. And yeah, I mean, routines, this is something that, you know, I think a lot of people have their routines, whether they realize it or not, they kind of do those same things, but just being consistent with a couple little things throughout your day, like you wake up the same time, or you wake up around the same time, you're eating around similar times, you're exercising around similar times. And so, you know, like there's people like you that have like weird schedules and all and different schedules each day. So I think it's really important to hold your routines lightly, to not lean on them too much. It's something that you don't necessarily like need, all right? Like, for instance, like you take big games, for example, you know, like take the Super Bowl, for example. You hear a lot of players talk about how the fact that they have to get there a couple days early, there's all the extra media, there's the prolonged pregame, there's the prolonged halftime show. Those are things that throw them out of your routine, right? And being creatures of habit, wanting that routine and having that routine thrown off, it messes with them mentally. So it's something that you should hold lightly. So maybe rather than waking up at the exact same time every day, maybe it's getting the same amount of sleep every night. And the first three things you do, whether it's like meditate, go for a walk, eat some breakfast, like just do that, whatever it is, time that you wake up. So using those routines and having that structure and the consistency, but holding it lightly and allowing it to be flexible and adaptable to your own needs and your own circumstances.
I think that's good advice. I'm glad you brought up the idea of big games and how the more the spotlight can throw off your routine, or just the pressure of a big, you know, the Super Bowl, Game 7, whatever it may be. It's another thing we kind of try to discount on the show, the idea of big game players, clutch versus choker. You know, Sergei Bobrovsky, really good goalie all the time. And then the playoffs start, and he's not. But then suddenly, you know, he has a good playoff and, okay, cool. So that's over with. And I always just kind of say good athletes are good athletes and give them enough time. That bears true. But there is something to guys who seem to come through in big games more and guys who kind of don't. What is it about some guys who thrive under pressure, some athletes who don't? Is there something to it?
You know, as a lifelong Eagles fan, you cannot
Yep.
I had my heart broken too many times as an adolescent for you to sit here and tell me that Tom Brady and Bill Belichick are not just clutch and McNabb and Reed are not just chokers.
Agreed.
As a professional in this field, I think there are some athletes that are just simply born with the psychological makeup that allow them to thrive under pressure. I think some guys are just wired that way to rise to the occasion. But I think similar to mental toughness, I think an athlete can develop the ability to thrive under pressure. I think using mental skills training to prepare you for that moment, you know, it's not, I think some guys just have it, but that doesn't mean that other guys don't, right? These guys can learn ways to get better under pressure. And the guys that are already good under pressure, you know, why not continue to
they could always be better, yeah.
Just because you do it once doesn't mean anything. Well, you know, won Super Bowl championship with the Eagles. It was freaking awesome.
I'm set.
I think a lot of it starts with a perspective. I think first and foremost, pressure is a perspective, right? How you look at the situation. Are you looking at the situation as, oh man, like, this is the playoffs, this is the biggest game of my life, this is what I've worked my whole life for. If I mess up, then I'm a failure and I blew it. Or are you looking at this like, man, like, this is awesome. Like, I get this really cool opportunity to go out here and play on the biggest stage, and I'm just going to let it rip and have some fun and enjoy this because this is something I worked really hard, and I earned this opportunity. So I always tell my athletes, pressure is a perspective, so make that perspective that it's a privilege. Because pressure really is a privilege. If you're in a pressure situation, it means you're doing something that has meaning.
Yeah.
You're doing something that matters, right?
You could just be, you know, mediocre forever, but to be in a pressure-packed situation, you had to get there somehow. So that's okay. I like absolutely. That. That's important.
Absolutely. I would also say that, you know what, I think if you were to ask what are considered the most clutch athletes of all time, I think if you ask them about this, what they would say is that thriving under pressure is about preparation and learning from your failures. I think the guys that thrive under pressure are so prepared for the situation that when the situation comes, it's just business as usual. There's so much attention to detail and nuance to their training and preparation that they're just ready for that moment. And I also think learning from your failures is so, so critical. I mean, you can learn so much and grow so much from your failures. And I think the players that are clutch, they're clutch because they learn from their failures, whereas the guys that are chokers, they make excuses and they blame others and they point the finger and they complain about their circumstances. You know? And learning from your failures is so important. You have to embrace the adversity. You have to face adversity because, for one, adversity is going to be inevitable on your journey to whatever big goals you have. If your goal is to win the Stanley Cup, you're going to face some challenges along the way. It's not going to be smooth sailing. There's going to be some bumps in the road. But the thing is, facing that adversity makes you so much stronger and so much prepared because the skills you're forced to learn and the lessons you're forced to learn in overcoming that adversity, it prepares you for the next challenge you're going to face. You know, I think about the St. Louis Blues. They were in last place midway through the season. They dug themselves in a huge hole. That is a tremendous amount of adversity to overcome. That is a tremendous amount of work to dig themselves out of that hole. But in digging themselves out of that hole and going through those challenges and overcoming that adversity, they were ready for whatever challenges they face in the playoffs. So, you know, when it came to game 7 in Boston, like, pressure, like, what? Like, this is another game. Like, you know, who cares? Because they were so ready for that moment.
The idea of learning from your failures, like you said, in any sport, you're going to fail. We talk about the most clutch athletes ever. Tom freaking Brady wasn't a full-time starter at Michigan. He was a sixth-round pick. He carries that shit with him, and he's the most celebrated athlete of all time. And still, he's like, yeah. Like, Michael Jordan still talks about getting cut from his high school team. It's like, dog, you're Michael Jordan. That confidence, the idea of learning from your failures, the only way to apply it to me is about confidence. And you and I have been talking, you know, before this, like, just about a guy like Rhys Hoskins and how he just goes into the tank sometimes. He's so streaky. And the idea that he's so hard on himself, you hear it so much. Like, Gabe Kapler, I mean, he's positive with everybody. But I think you can really see it in the way he talks about Hoskins when Hoskins is cold. He just goes, we have all the confidence in the world in Rhys. He's going to hit home runs and doubles. It's going to be fine. Like, trying to balance out not even how negative he is, just how hard he is on himself and how much pressure he puts on himself. You could be the highest level athlete there is. If you lose your confidence, that's it. How do you regain confidence? Like, if you can have it and lose it, where does it go and how the hell do you find it?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, yes, confidence is important. It is often a prerequisite for success, but I think our society has completely overrated confidence. I think it's a lot easier to do something when you are feeling confident, and it's a lot harder when you're not feeling confident. So I always tell athletes, man, like, I'd rather you be courageous than confident. Because to have the courage to, you know, have some doubt and experience but still go out there and do it, you know, I think that's more powerful than having confidence. With that being said, there is a lot of science and research to back that having self-confidence generally leads to more success. You know, like, you can have all the confidence in the world and still fail. You can be filled with doubt and still succeed. But generally speaking, if you're feeling confident, you're giving yourself a better chance to be successful. So we always throw this word confidence around. Well, what exactly is it? And when you look at the root words of confidence, the Latin root words of confidence, you have con and fidere, which roughly translates to with fidelity, with trust. Confidence is all about trust. It's about trusting your training. It's about trusting your skills. It's about trusting your instincts. Confidence is, it comes down to having trust in yourself. So how do you develop it? Well, what do you think comes first, Bill? Do you think confidence comes first, or do you think success comes first?
See, that's a big chicken and the egg thing. When we talk about preparedness, like, I can see why that's, like, I was not confident that I could do this interview with you until I prepared for it, you know? Like, and now I'm prepared, so I'm confident that this doesn't sound like shit, because I don't sound like a buffoon. So, so I guess you would have to be prepared before you're confident, and then in the future, you can draw upon your success to be confident? Am I, like, on the right track here?
Absolutely. You know what? Which comes first, confidence or success? It's a chicken or the egg argument, you know? They're both.
Yeah,
okay. You're absolutely right. So there's two ways to understanding confidence. There's the outside-in approach and the inside-out approach. And so what the outside-in approach to confidence is that you experience success, and that leads to confidence, whereas the inside-out approach is you have the feeling of confidence first, and that leads to success. Now, they both work. There's legitimateness to both. I would say I would encourage an athlete to draw more from that inside-out approach, because it's just simply more stable. You know, so much of the outcomes is out of your control. So if you're basing all your confidence on wins and losses or your stats, like, you're not really setting yourself up in a good place. But, you know, where does confidence come from? Very simply, your self-talk. Confidence comes from the internal dialogue you're having. It comes from the things you're telling yourself. So a guy like Rhys Hoskins, who's really struggling, like, it's hard to have positive self-talk when you're not having the results you're wanting. And, you know, it's a guy, he's working his ass off, and it's a guy that really wants to win. It's a guy that is very competitive. He's very motivated. He expects a lot out of himself. And to be working that as hard as he is, and to know that he has the ability to do it but not experiencing the success, it's really hard to stay confident through that. I think the key to your self-talk is that, first of all, it doesn't have to be all sunshine and rainbows. You know, if you go 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts and you come into the clubhouse and go, golly gee whiz, man, we sure had fun today. Like, I'm going to beat your head over with a bat. Like, no. The confidence should be credible. The self-talk should be credible, but there's got to be some kind of positive direction towards it. So there's a big difference between saying, man, like, I was 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts. Like, I stink. I'm in a brutal cold streak. I'm never going to figure out. I don't know what the heck's going on. The media's going to be all over me. What you can simply say is, all right, you know, I put a couple good at-bats together. What did I do well here? All right, what can I do better? How can I do that better? Say, you know what, like, yeah, you know what, I went 0-for-4, but I ripped that one into the gap, and the center fielder made an unbelievable diving catch. What am I going to do about that? I think one of the big keys to confidence is to lean it in your process and your performance rather than the outcomes.
Okay.
So much of the outcomes are out of your control. You can rip a ball into the gap and the center fielder makes an unbelievable catch. You can rip a shot top right corner and the goalie just makes an unbelievable glove save. You could hit a little blooper down the third baseline that barely lands in fair and it turns into a double. You can take a shot from the red line that goes off of someone's stick and trickles into the net. So much of the outcome is completely out of your control. So focus on the process. You know, like, if you're putting good at-bats together and, you know, the hits aren't just coming, roll with that. If you're, you know, you're buzzing around the net and you're getting good scoring chances, like, don't worry about the fact that the puck's not going in. Just keep doing what you're doing well. Learn from your mistakes, and eventually you'll get there.
I want to get into the idea a little bit now of how coaches can apply this stuff. We talked about, I mentioned Gabe Kapler, like, he is very much all about that positive reinforcement. And if Reese comes up and has three strikeouts, it's like, well, he had that one at bat where he's really seeing the ball, so we like that, and we're going to build on that. And like with the Flyers, we've heard a lot about late, like over the last few years, how hard Claude Giroux is on himself and how up and down emotionally Shane Gostisbehere is. Whatever the issue is that a coach is dealing with, manager, whomever, how does a coach apply some of these mental skills? Is it, again, just a case-by-case basis? Is there an overarching way to apply it?
Well, Bill, the simple answer to your question is for coaches to reach out to their local CAPEX Consulting mental training and peak performance specialist to learn about some of our coaching enrichment programs. On a more serious note, I think one of the first things a coach can do to help their players to develop mental toughness is for themselves as coaches to develop some emotional intelligence. So their ability to empathize with others and also be self-aware of themselves and how they're presenting themselves. And, you know, when the Eagles hired Doug Peterson...
I was going to say, that was the phrase, emotional intelligence.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of research and science now in the corporate world of how important emotional intelligence is for all leaders. So I think that's a really good place to start. And really, I think what emotional intelligence comes down to is the way you communicate with your players. I recently saw on ESPN, they had that 150 years of college football documentary.
Yeah.
And Nick Saban was talking about how coaching has changed from when he was a player to now. And he said, when he was a player, the coach told you what to do, and you just did it. Now, in this day and age, the athletes are so skilled. They're so experienced. They have so much knowledge of the game. He says that you can't, it's not enough just to tell them what to do. It's not enough just to tell them how to do it. If you want them to buy into it, you got to tell them why. You got to have open and honest lines of communication, right? So, you know, like if you have a guy that, as a coach, who he really wants to be the first line center, but you're looking at him as more of like a third, fourth line kind of guy, you can either tell him, you're going to play third or fourth line because I'm the coach and that's what I told you. Well, you know what? That guy's probably not going to give it his all. But if you say to him, listen, man, I understand that you think you should be a first line center. And you know what? You're right. Like, you have a great skill set. You're offensively talented. You can score a lot of goals. But the reality is the guys in front of you are more experienced and they're just better at it, right? So you're going to play this third, fourth line because that's what's best for the team. And that's going to give us the best chance to succeed. Now, if you buy into this role, you're going to make the team better. We're going to go deeper in the playoffs. There's going to be more game footage on you. You're going to get more opportunities to sign that big contract down the road, right? And so I think the days of the tyrannical coach, the authoritarian coach that, you know, just screams and hollers and yells and tells you, you're going to do this because I said so, that's kind of dying out. And coaches are understanding how important it is to have that emotional intelligence so that they can really communicate and you know, relate to their players so that the players will ultimately buy in.
That's some good stuff. And like Donato said, he is a – damn it, I forgot your title again. Where'd it go? Here it is. Mental training and peak performance specialist at CAPEX Consulting. You're in Pittsburgh. Are there more locations, or how does it work?
We are located in Pittsburgh. However, we do offer consultations over Skype, potentially.
Okay.
So if anyone's interested in checking and learning a little bit more about what we do, check out our website, capexconsulting.com, and then feel free to reach us through there, or people can also follow me on Twitter and reach out to me there, and I'd be happy to answer any questions people have.
You can follow Donato at Don Otto. I love your at. It's really funny. It's just phonetical, D-O-N-A-H-T-O-E. You can follow him there. Man, I really enjoyed this, and I think our listeners are going to take something out of it. Is there anything you think we didn't get to that you really want to make sure to drive home with people? Because this is a complex issue. You can go on about it. You're into it. But, like, what should people really take away from this interview?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think next time we do this interview, I just want to spend the whole time breaking down the difference in mindset between Chip Kelly and Doug Peterson.
Oh, God.
Man, that would be a fun rabbit hole to go down to. My biggest, I think the biggest thing I want people to take away from this is that, you know, these are skills. These are something that can be developed with proper training and practice and patience, and, you know, start early. And these are things that are not just for athletes. These are not skills that are just for athletes. You know, they can be applied to dancers, musicians, firefighters, police officers, EMTs, military. You know, really it comes down to who wouldn't benefit by being more confident, motivated, and focused in anything that they do in their life. So these are things that, you know, yes, they're going to help athletes reach peak performance levels, but, you know, these can help you in your everyday life and whatever pursuits you have.
All right, man. Thanks a lot. Thank you for joining us. Again, this is a BSH special episode with Donato Finelli, a mental training and peak performance specialist at Capex Consulting. Again, I think people are really going to dig this. And the Carter Hart tie-in. I mean, that's all anyone needs, dude. That's all anyone needs. So thanks for...
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Oh, thanks for joining us. And everyone out there, thanks for listening. Thanks for hanging out. My name is Bill Matz. Until next week, have a great week, everybody.